Welcome to the Faith Element Podcast for the September 3rd, 2017 session, focusing on Exodus 3, verses 1 through 15, Invitation to Become. I'm David Cassidy.
I'm Nikki Hardiman.
I'm Burt Montgomery.
I'm Anthony Neal.
I'm David Adams.
Daniel is not able to be with us tonight, and we will miss Daniel. But we are very excited to have two guests with us. One you probably have heard before on the podcast. That's David Adams. We're very happy to have David back with us. Of course, David teaches at Baptist Seminary of Kentucky, where I also am. And David, we welcome you back.
Thank you.
But we also have a first-timer with us, and we're very excited about that, Dr. Anthony Neal. Anthony is the author of Common Ground, a comparison of the ideas of consciousness in the writings of Howard Thurman and Huey Newton. And he's taught at Morehouse College, Spelman College, Payne College, and currently he teaches there with Burt at Mississippi State University.
Yes, indeed.
Hail State.
Hail State.
And there he is the assistant professor of philosophy and religion. Anthony, we welcome you to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you.
Now, obviously, you know Burt because you both teach at Mississippi State, but I understand that you also know Nikki. Can you tell us how you know Nikki?
Yes, we went to seminary together at McAfee School of Theology. I met Nikki when she was just a young student, and we had a lot of fun during those 3 years. McAfee at that time was rather small, so we all got to know each other very well.
It's true. It's true. They were a good 3 years.
Yes, they were.
You know, it's interesting. You do make friendships in those times that tend to stick around. That's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Anthony, we're very happy you're with us today. So we are well into our journey through Exodus. We're going to be in Exodus for a few weeks, and we have a very familiar passage to discuss this episode. So, David Adams, would you help us get started with this chat?
Sure. When I was growing up, we had some pretty fixed notions on who God was and what God wanted us to do. It's hard to ask questions about faith, fate, omniscience, and human destiny when you're singing Jesus Loves Me and eating those little windmill-shaped shortbread cookies and drinking red stuff and coloring Bible pictures. I'm sure the adults were going on about things, but it seems to me that most of the conversations I heard out of them were centered on archaeology and sending missionaries, with a little bit of how to share their testimony thrown in for good measure. No one really talked about how God might feel about things like war, civil rights, justice, and other such themes. I know that they felt strongly about them, but those things never came to church. It was a wonderful time for some. But now that I'm a creaking old man, I kind of wish we'd talked a little more about how our sense of God's relationship with people ought to affect the way we do things. These days, with my fancy education and all, I try to look pretty hard on how people understand God to be working in the world and how our beliefs about such a thing might affect the kind of world we live in. Someone once gave me a John Calvin bobblehead, knowing that I have a penchant for collecting such things, and I sometimes display it, but possibly not for the reason intended. This is mostly because once I left my safe little church in the country to go out to the larger world, I began to notice some real differences in how the people approach faith. On the one hand, there are people who believe in what I see as a more static universe, where everything was created and will move along according to a divine plan, and God has chosen an elect group of people as part of that plan who are somehow better than the rest of us. Taken to extremes, I guess we could save a lot of time with that approach. After all, if God has everything all planned out and it cannot be changed, we can save all the time we waste going to church and praying and whatnot. After all, it is what it is, so faith doesn't really matter. Unless, of course, you're praying for God to reveal his choice of Super Bowl winners in advance, or something like that. Unfortunately, very few of the folks who want to take Calvinism to extremes tend to think of it that way. Instead, we're more likely to hear that since God has chosen all of life's winners and losers in advance, people are poor because God wants them to be that way. And people are rich because God favors them. Faith in a supreme being who loves all of creation can get replaced with an absolute certainty that apartheid, social Darwinism, racism, and widespread injustice and oppression of all types are just fine. After all, nothing happens that is not preordained by God, so the fact that such social evils exist is merely the working out of God's divine plan. I guess that if you understand yourself to be one of the elect, this approach has a lot of appeal. Of course, God planned for me to say that, so it's okay. Now, I'm sure that there are some very fine people on both sides of this notion about whether God intentionally singles out people to be oppressed. On my side, however, we tend to talk about a guy named Arminius and the notion that God has gifted people with the ability to make choices about being good or evil. A number of us even go so far as to talk about God's purpose rather than plan for things, and might even see ourselves as agents working with our God to enable things to work out according to that purpose. I admit that such statements sound a little bit like the second chapter of Philippians, but I think that God intends for me to share such things with you. Some of us think we're supposed to look at the various broken things in the world and ask what we can do to help fix them, instead of writing them off as a working of some secret plan. We would, after all, be God's partners in working to bring about the creation that God intends, instead of being complacent rats in a maze, playing our preordained role while celebrating the fact that such a role mysteriously favors us somehow and puts others down. I guess I've come to the point where I feel certain that creation is still happening, and I have a responsibility to work with the God I love and that loves me in trying to make it as good as it can be. I think this approach beats saying that creation is over and done with, and if I don't like the deal some people got, too bad. Now, obviously, I'm taking a very complex set of questions and breaking them down into caricature and oversimplification. There might even be a teensy little bit of satire in there, somewhere. This is where my mind goes when I see stories like Moses and the Burning Bush. Setting aside the various theories about the Hyksos, the Hapiru, the Shasu, and the other Semitic tribes who are suffering once the political tables had turned in Egypt, this is a story about when God emerged from among other gods, followed by various oppressed peoples of the day, and how God started a spiritual revolution that extends beyond the political one of that time. I'm not a big fan of what those tribes were doing when they united and conquered other people, but I am a big fan of setting aside following various gods of whatever leader had power at the time, in favor of understanding that God made us and calls us. As the great classical actor Christopher Lambert reminded us, there can be only one. As the narrative tells us, God hears the cries of the people who are held in bondage. God is moved by their suffering, and perhaps in no little part by the fact that they're being oppressed by the kind of people who had willingly tossed babies into the river in order to keep their wealth and power. In the face of this injustice, God appears in a burning bush to a dirty, stuttering shepherd who did his best to weasel out of God's call. We're lucky that he had a brother who was willing to play along, or we'd still be worrying about whether those poor folks were ever going to escape. I'm even a bigger fan of the idea that God, as we've come to know God in the biblical narrative, is a God who is always active and in process. Just as you can never tell someone's life story while they're still living, we come to know God as alive and continuing to shape the story. More than just the God who is, as the name implies, God has always been and forever will be part of the fabric of creation. This is a powerful shift in a world that is used to smaller, more materially focused gods who people choose to follow for one reason or another. People still do that kind of thing every day, even though they don't call it that, and this is the kind of thing against which people of faith continue to stand. Our God was forged out of a sense of deliverance from oppression and injustice. Even while God's followers were committing heinous acts of their own, they still stopped to wrestle with the fact that this kind of thing took them away from God. From commandments not to oppress the resident aliens who live among us, to prophetic writings condemning the wealthy for selling the needy for a pair of shoes, the people who came to follow the God Moses met in the burning bush shows that our God is uncomfortable with oppression, even among the faithful. There's no free pass for some elect group that gets to have all the nice stuff and treat the rest of us any way they want. Ours is a God who has a higher purpose for us, and who has not locked us into a universe with no options. Even though, sometimes it hurts to see what we do with such options.
I grew up in a Baptist church and was taught to some degree an element of the social gospel, Walter Rauschenbusch and things like, to some degree. But I was also very much surrounded by the whiteness of Baptist church, even in Louisiana in the 1980s. And it wasn't until I was in college before I began to realize and be exposed to the story of Moses and the story of Exodus and its importance in the civil rights movement. I remember the very first time I heard someone say, well, that African-Americans, I've heard an African-American refer to Martin Luther King Jr. as a Moses-like figure. And I remember being offended by that at first. This has nothing to do with the Exodus and Egypt. And then I began to have to realize that, yeah, it is. And the story, there's a lot in that story that resonates with the story of the African-American plight in the United States, and the, you know, freedom for my people and let my people go, things like that. So I'm curious. I'm thrilled that Anthony Neal is with us today. And I don't think you mentioned this in his introduction, but he's also with the African American Studies at Mississippi State University. And being African American Christian and Baptist and seminary graduate and theologian, as well as just a philosopher and all-around intelligent guy, well-read in many fields. Anthony, how does this connect with what we've seen and with the civil rights movement, with the abolitionist movement? Because for me as a white guy, it was always something that occurred in history and got us the history of the Passover, which is why Jesus ended up having a Last Supper, which is now our Lord's Supper. And that's pretty, you know, cut and dry. You know? And every year we would watch Moses on TV, played by Charlton Heston. There wasn't something that resonated of liberation and freedom. So you talk.
I guess for me, I'm certainly a long ways from a Bible literalist. So I tend to, and you know this from even when I came to your church and spoke, I tend to go back and forth between trying to figure out what should be allegory, metaphor, or literal. And somewhere in the middle. And the kind of space where I come from, even though eventually I left the Baptist church, but I grew up in a Baptist church, would have used this and would have thought in a nonlinear type of space. And this would have been something that was going to happen over and over again. That these types of things, somebody would be oppressing somebody, and there would be a need for a type of liberation moment. And so when I hear the story, I don't automatically go to what God did in the story, but I start off with what the people are doing, right? There's the shock of seeing a bush burning but not being consumed. And so that's this type of initiation into a particular type of being that Moses is expected to be, and so you even see the his mother playing a part, the nursemaids or the nurses, the people who are going to have to deliver the babies, they play a part. Pharaoh's sister plays a part in all of this. So in some ways, even before we get to what God is doing, there's certainly a lot of what the people are expected to do themselves. And then at a moment where they can do no more, their actions are extended by God. So that's sort of how I see it in an approximated way. I know that may be convoluted. I don't know. So when I hear people being compared to Moses, that is a motif that is used in many Black churches I have been in over and over again. In fact, the burning bush experience, people are expected to have a burning bush experience, this sort of from darkness to light type of experience, this experience that wakes you up to be bigger than you are. And I tell you, when I was in seminary, I got an opportunity to meet Jürgen Moltmann. And he spoke at Emory. And so, you know, I said, I'm not going to waste the opportunity. I'm going to you know, at the end of this thing, I'm going to talk to him because I want to say he was in his 90s then, late 80s, early 90s. So I said, you know, what's the chances of me getting a chance to talk to him again? Right. And so I got a chance to talk to him and tried to figure out where, what I thought about theology and things of that nature, where it kind of connected to his theology of hope. And he shared with me a few things. He said that, and this is just what I understood through his accent, okay, which was very thick, but he said that he thought the world was coming to an end, right? And but since it didn't come to an end, that in the way that he thought about the theology of hope, if there were no ability to make the world better, then Christians have no work. The text for us sort of ends if there's no possibility to make the world better, right? And so that has resonated with me with how I think about religion in general, Christianity specifically. If as practicing Christians, if there is no possibility to make the world better, if the world is all that it needs to be right now, then what are we doing? And if there's no possibility, if we look at the world, even with the situations that we're going through right now, and Christians specifically can't make the world better, then we're in trouble.
I like the idea, too, that, as you pointed out, God is moving all the time through people's lives. They might be open to it. They might even know that God's got a purpose for them and is working through them. But God's there moving, whether we see it or not. And maybe we don't even need so spectacular a moment as a bush spontaneously bursting into flames but not burning up. But occasionally we have to have those moments because sometimes we just flat miss it and we miss chances. And we can't afford to do that. We've got too much to do. We don't have time to waste.
The Bible is kind of written like a Tarantino movie. And what I mean by that is Tarantino, he tries to go back and recapture all of the scenes that you missed while you were watching the main scene. Mm. And so it becomes a very confusing movie if you're not used to Tarantino's style, right? So there's a way in which the Bible tries to tell all of these stories in the background. So there's this, but we miss some of the stories, like what's going on with Pharaoh's a sister at the time where the that Moses' mother is placing him in the water.
Yeah.
We don't get a chance to. So the idea is that she's living a good life, right? What is Pharaoh doing while Moses' mother is at the moment of trying to save her child's life by placing him in the water? What's going on with Moses? I mean with Pharaoh? What's going on with the women who deliver babies? Well, this mother is making a life or death choice, placing her son in the reeds, and think about that. I think that the reason that becomes important when I went to seminary, I had a doctor, Lord Allen, for church history. Very sharp guy. So we get there in 2002, and the seminary had opened in 96. And so it was not old. And when I got there, Dr. McSwain had just gotten there. Peter Ray Jones was my advisor. And so I had all of these guys for professors, and there was a lot of talk in each class about the good old days of the Southern Baptist Convention. Right? So when I got to church history, once I stopped the class was about 30 or 40 people, and I sat sort of in the back. And I stopped the class, and I asked the question, when you say the good days of the Southern Baptist Convention, what days are you talking about? And I said, because I want you to know how it sounds when you say that, right? Because all of the days that you're talking about are the days that blacks were excluded from the Southern Baptist Church. And so that's why, in connection with what was Pharaoh's sister doing, I live a pretty good life. But I have to, at some moment, stop and think about, well, what are people who have things worse than I am? What are they going through? while when I'm out at a nice restaurant in Atlanta, I'm kind of back and forth between Starkville and Atlanta because my wife lives in Atlanta right now until she has about 3 more years before she retires. And so I go back and forth. I like to eat at nice restaurants. I went to Vienna this summer doing some scholarship there. What are people who are struggling? There are many people that don't have good health care. What are they doing while I'm living a pretty good life? I think about I was in the Honors Building, and I was talking to a student. And there was a young man there painting a wall. Well, I've never really had a job like that really in my life that I had to work. So I'm always thinking about, well, what are these other people doing? So Pharaoh's daughter, while she was living a pretty good life, she was not necessarily concerned about Moses' family. It just so happened she was getting something out of the deal. She was getting a baby out of the deal. But she was not necessarily concerned about Moses' family. In fact, when she says, go get someone to feed this child, the purpose of going to get someone to feed this child, because that's going to free her up. That's going to allow her some moment of leisure. This woman is basically working for her. It's not a benefit for the woman. It just so happened to be Moses' mother.
Nikki, both you and David Adams have referenced this idea of a God that is moving with us through life, and that we have freedom to make choices. And I guess I can't help but be struck by this image of a burning bush, because it's, in many ways, it's a contradiction, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
It's not being consumed, so it's as if it's static. Mm-hmm. But it can't be static, because fire is one of the least static things we know, right? I mean, fire, we even use fire as a symbol for spirit, mm-hmm. right? I mean, it's moving, it's dynamic, mm-hmm. it's active. And so I know, I wonder as I listen, because often I know, you know, we believe that there is this God that is eternal, right? That is timeless, that is beyond time, that is there for us, that is steadfast. So it's very much like this bush that's not consumed. But at the same time, we experience this God that moves through life with us, that is there shaping life, that is beckoning us, much as Moses was beckoned, to do things, to pay attention to others, to be part of changing the world for better. I don't know. Is that part of what you were maybe trying to get at with this idea of a God that is moving?
Well, I mean, I took the idea from, well, the short answer is, yeah, I think that is getting at it. And, you know, I took the idea from this obscure little, not obscure, I mean, everybody knows this work. Moses says, you know, who will I say sent me? And God says, say, I am that I am. I mean, almost any English translation that you pick up of this passage, that's about how it's translated. I am, tell them, I am, has sent you. And the challenge, of course, is, and whenever we translate the Hebrew or the Greek, is that sometimes we run into things that don't have direct translations, or that they don't easily translate into our own language. And so if we were going to directly, it's a imperfect present tense. I think that's right. If any of you know Hebrew better than me, check that out. But I'm pretty sure it's an imperfect present tense. But even if I don't have that exactly right, what I do know is that the verb that's used here, it's indicating continual action. This action that never stops. So we have this verb indicating this perpetual action. And now that you bring up the fire, like, that makes sense, right? Like, you have this fire that is burning. And you know, you can imagine, I mean, so many of us have just sat and stared at a campfire or the fire that was made in our house, and they're mesmerizing and you can't take your eyes off of them, and they're flickering and kind of constantly moving. But the idea that this is constantly, the fire is constantly engaged with the bush, but the bush doesn't burn. I think, you know, there's a connection there. So if we were going to translate it, this idea of perpetual action, we might say, I will be that I will be. Like, that's not real proper English, or that's not how we would naturally say it in the English, which is why we translated I am that I am. But this idea of I will be that I will be is really a better translation of these words. And I don't think that means that God is incomplete. But I do think, for me, it means that God is in relationship. I mean, at this particular point in the story, God is in relationship with Israel, or the Hebrew people, really. They're not even Israel yet. They haven't come together to be formed that way yet. But God is in relation to these Hebrew people who are oppressed in Egypt. And when you watch the storyline of God and Israel, because that's what this is, right? This is a story of God and the Israelite people. God is constantly navigating and negotiating that relationship. You know, Moses gets God to change God's mind, and God is constantly saying to them, do this or you will surely be destroyed. And then they're given chance two and chance three and chance 100 and chance 1,000. Perpetually, God is working with these people, and God is negotiating and navigating that relationship.
See, I kind of plugged into it a couple of different ways, because typically, when you read the Bible and you go to seminary and you do all that cool stuff and read the Bible in ways that you never read it growing up, you learn that we get these new terms that come in because suddenly we know these other languages, mm-hmm. and we're exposed to them and concepts that come from them. Mm-hmm. So you read the New Testament and you see the aoric tense used so often. The idea of as you go or as you do these things, not punctiliar like you accomplish something, but you're going to be doing things. And while you do, here's what Jesus is asking you to do. And you read the Old Testament and you get this idea that there's a more holistic view of things, that you can't just look at somebody and say that's what they are. You have to look at the totality of their existence to know what they are. And when you have that broader view of things, it's a lot harder to just stick a label on somebody and say that's what they are and that's what their life has to be. It's a lot easier to look at something bigger and say they're on their way to being what they ultimately will become and celebrate that. But when you research the archaeology behind this passage, which, because I used to really be into that, and you see these different tribes that in history we know were kind of in the area, and a lot of this is lost through time. But there's this idea of a personal God that a lot of these Semitic tribes have in common. And you may hear people talk about the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, you know, as if they had a personal God that they dealt with. It's different from the God someone else had. And we move in this idea of henotheism, which was, we'll just have this one God apiece, to monotheism. There's only one of them. And the process of emerging as a monotheistic worldview, where suddenly we realize that God is God and God will be God, they had a choice of lots of different names to use here. Mm-hmm. But Yahweh was around for the Shosu hundreds of years before it was written down for any of these other tribes. And this is a tribe of people who, by definition, they didn't move around. They didn't live in cities. They moved around all the time. They're active. Their verb forms, the language they use was active words. Mm-hmm. They're always in the process of doing something else and moving from place to place and never being settled. Some would even argue that they got their name because they're just mendicants who wander around doing stuff all the time. They never stop and sit still. Mm. So when you've got a choice to pick which God you want to say is the aspect of the one God that you choose to follow, they chose the active one, the one who doesn't sit still, the one who's always on the way to do something, the one who's not just going to be confined, but the one who's loose in the world and making some changes and, yes, causing disruption, you know, because the God that was chosen to be our God, or the way we've come to understand God, is a God that cares about us and the people of this world enough to not sit still and not let things be, but to cause disruption and let us continue to become. So, you know, my natural inclination towards Arminianism, it was pretty easy to pick up on that one and say, wow, I like this image. Mm-hmm. I like where you're going with your process. But there still is something about a burning bush that doesn't actually burn. You know, it's in the process of becoming ashes, isn't it? Isn't it going to become destroyed? But it doesn't get destroyed. It's there and it endures through all this, and it draws attention to itself. I mean, those are some really good, powerful images of a God that can call people together and really make some change and do something. They can really break through, as we were talking about earlier. And it's wonderful to see this passage, if nothing else, as a place in the narrative where we start thinking about God that way. And because up to that point, we didn't really think of God that way, but here we do. It's the God whose voice speaks to us from a burning bush, who's the ground around the bush is holy ground, where you have to take off your shoes, you know, and calls unlikely people to do unlikely things. And God is breaking through because people are suffering and God wants to put a stop to it.
Well, I think it's interesting that even when you move towards the New Testament, it's this idea of God coming back for a church. So not one person. Mm-hmm. But also, just to his point earlier, when you read it in the Hebrew, and I haven't read Hebrew for a while because it was just a harder language than the Greek.
Amen.
But one of the things, you get this idea of the birth pains of a woman over and over again. Right. And so there's this sense that you get out of even the New Testament, the fullness of time. Right. And so Moses, the child Moses was born at the right time. Right. At the point where the there was a swell of emotion out of the people, where so that God allowed the people to know that God was still with the people. Right. And so at the moment where the swell of the pain or whatever of the people grew enough, we get the birth of Moses, and we get the connection between God and Moses in the same way that you get. And I've always made this connection, but it's not a necessary one. But when we look at Luke chapter 2, there's a point where it says Caesar Augustus issued a decree that the whole world should be taxed, right? And it's very similar to what's going on in Exodus, that there's this pain from the people, the people of Israel upset about the decree enough where you get the birth of Jesus. So it seems that there's that kind of connection between that story and the other story, that there is just something in the mix. And I've often heard it said that, you know, Benjamin Mays talked about when he talked about at Morehouse, had it not been King, it would have been someone else, because there was enough of whatever placed in the mix at Morehouse that they knew that somebody would grow out of that mix to be a leader such that King was. You'd had John Hope there. You had W.E.B. Du Bois at Atlanta University talking about the talented 10th. You had Mays coming back to be the president. E. Franklin Frazier was also teaching there. All of these people were there that somebody was going to rise up. And now I don't know how necessarily you have to kind of go with some type of providence to think that that's the case, but certainly there was enough placed in the mix where you get something out of it. And I think when we look backwards to the Israelites, you get this idea that all of the people are talking about, what are we going to do? We can't allow our babies to be killed. What are we going to do about this, right? And so that there's this groundswell. And what is God in, like, Psalms, I think it's 41, where is your God? Where is God, right? I think that's very interesting, you know, where is God? That idea of God coming in just before the people totally lose faith. And when Moses first goes there, it's not, he doesn't ask Pharaoh to let the people go. He asked Pharaoh to let the people go and reconnect with their God. It's only when Pharaoh says, no, we can't do that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's when they say, okay, it was just, let us get back to being God's people. I always thought that was really interesting.
Well, thank you all for this conversation around what is a very familiar passage. Maybe this passage and our conversation today can be a source of thought for us and prayer in the days ahead, that I wonder sometimes if it's too easy to focus on the part of the bush that's not being consumed instead of on the flame that keeps burning. Because I think we believe in a God that is still burning in this world and still hearing the cries of the oppressed and caring for God's people. May we do our part in leading and serving and changing the world in God's name.
Faith Element is a service of Faith Lab.